You're listening to a podcast from Streams Church in the West Valley of Phoenix, Arizona. For more audio and visual content, visit streamschurch.org. We're talking about the bad boys of Easter. And you know, this is the time of the year where I feel like we kind of draw near to Jesus. And I've been really close to Jesus this week. I've been really tight with him because I filed my taxes this week. And I don't know, maybe you guys are, yeah, somebody relates hardcore to that. I don't know, maybe you guys are like me, but my taxes are like this mysterious caged creature that I like feed once a year. And I have no idea what it's going to do. It's like this black box where I don't understand what happens. And so I just feed everything in to my tax lady and she comes back and tells me what happens. And I try and figure it out myself every year. I think, I can, how hard can it be, right? So I put everything into TurboTax and I go to my wife, Sam, and I'm like, babe, I don't know what happened, but we're going to owe $40,000 this year. I don't know how. And she just rolls her eyes and goes, okay, babe. And so then I go back and I do it again. And then I come back and I go, okay, I missed a couple of things. I missed a couple of deductions. We're actually getting $100,000 back. So this is the best year ever. And I do that 4 or 5 times and she just ignores me and says, would you just send everything off to the tax lady? And then I finally do and she's some sort of wizard and it all comes back fine. But I find myself, especially in this time, tempted to bargain with God. You ever bargain with God? Like I'm sitting there, I'm looking at all these IRS forms, having no idea what to do with them, trying to decipher the instructions, subtract line 39A from line 47, if it's greater than zero, multiply it by, divided by zero, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, Lord, if you'll just let this come back okay, if you'll just help me to not be a tax criminal, whatever you want me to do, I will do it. What do you want me to do? What do you need from me that I'm not giving? And we bargain with God. It's such a temptation to say, God, if you do this for me, I will do this for you. If you will, I will. God, get my boss to figure out his life, and I will go to church way more often. I'll be there every time the doors are open, right? God, help my kid to not fail chemistry for the third time in a row, and I will do something. It's such a temptation to bargain with God. And then when God doesn't hold up his end of the bargain in our eyes, that's it. We're done. Forget it. I'm not going to do that. Because you didn't do for me what I asked you to do. So I'm not responsible. I don't have to do that. You didn't hold up your end of the bargain. Since God didn't, forget it. We reason that if God had behaved the way that we expected him to behave, then we would have behaved the way that we said we were going to behave. The equation becomes unbalanced. We'd still believe, we'd still give, we'd still reach out, we'd still be in community, we'd still be in connection. But God didn't, so I'm not going to. Today's bad boy tried to get Jesus to do his bidding. And when he didn't, he bailed. Just completely left. The bad news and the truth is, there's a little bit of this guy in all of us. Now, this person was a pretender and a thief, but not a thief in the traditional sense. Like he didn't, you know, rob convenience stores or anything. He didn't necessarily steal things. But he was kind of a con artist. With this guy, there were three sides to every story. The right side, the wrong side, and his side. And his side was the side where he stood the most to benefit from whatever situation he was in. He was always looking at every situation and doing some calculations to find out how he could benefit. He was always trying to find out where the most benefit was. When there was a tangible benefit to following Jesus, when there was a social benefit, when there was a political benefit to following Jesus and being an outspoken follower of Jesus, by golly, he was right there. And then when that started to change, when it became apparent that there was more to be gained by siding against Jesus than with him, he flipped. His loyalty was singular, and it was to himself. Today we're talking about Judas. Judas' story is relevant to us because there is something in us that desperately wants to leverage God's power for our own gain. We want to take what God has and use it for ourselves and figure out how to make God do what we want him to do. And when he's no longer willing to work for us in our eyes, we bolt. Whether that means physically leaving or cutting a part of ourselves off from him, we don't agree to deal with him anymore. And we've all done this before. If you'll get my wife to, or my husband to, if you'll just get that girl to notice me, or that guy to notice me, if you'll help me get that job, if you'll help me figure out my finances, if you'll heal me, if you make sure my parents don't find out about that, we do it all the time. For Judas, Jesus was a means to an end. His end. In every situation, Jesus was nothing more than a means to an end. Unfortunately, he wasn't alone, because the disciples did the same thing. You guys have probably heard the story of the rich young ruler. The man comes before Jesus and says, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" Jesus said, "You follow all the commandments." The guy says, "Great, I've totally done that." And Jesus goes, "Awesome. The only thing else you have to do is sell everything, give the money to the poor, and come follow me." And the guy runs, he goes away sad. He's disappointed about that. So the disciples are amazed by this whole process, and so the wheels are starting to turn. Peter's looking at this situation. He's like, "Okay, I gave everything up." Right? Matthew's going, "I left my family. I gave lots of things up. I like where this is going." So they're all kind of thinking this, I feel like. And then Peter has to open his mouth, right? And Peter says this in Matthew 19, 27. We have probably all thought this at one point or another. Then Peter said to him, "We've given up everything to follow you. What do we get? What's in it for us? What's the prize at the end of this train?" See, this is what the bargain boils down to. This understanding that there's an equation that needs balancing. That there's some math that comes out of balance if we don't get something at the end of all of this. That there should be something tangible. I gave up my old life. What do I get in return? I give every month. What do I get in return? I volunteer once or twice a month. What do I get in return? There's this equation in our minds that is constantly being balanced and unbalanced. This is the question that Judas asked in every situation. And he was really crafty about it, because he was always looking at it. If I go this way, I'll get that. But if I go this way, I'll get this. And if I go this way, this is probably the best way. So he's constantly thinking about this. It must have been exhausting. And then at the end of this three-year run with the disciples, when Jesus was arrested, all 12 disciples walked away for a time, because in their mind, the equation had become unbalanced in their mind. There was no longer anything to gain from them following Jesus. They had invested all of this time and all of this effort, and then Jesus got arrested. And so what they thought they were going to see happen, they were no longer going to see, so they all left for a time. Now, all of them came back, except for one, Judas. Judas wasn't a dummy. Judas was a pretty smart guy. And if you look at some of his logic, you can see in our humanity how this would have made sense. See, there were a lot of prophecies about who the Messiah was going to be and what he was going to do. Right? And a lot of these prophecies, as Judas watched, he could see Jesus fulfilling them. He could see that he was checking off some of the requirements. But there were some really glaring ones in Judas's mind that did not get fulfilled. Most notably, Jesus did not hate the Romans nearly enough. See, the Jews were convinced that this Messiah was going to be a military leader who would help join them together and then overthrow this occupation. So they were on the lookout for somebody who was military-minded, who was strategic, who was outspoken against the Romans. That's what they were looking for, and Jesus didn't quite fit that bill because he even paid taxes. He didn't hate the Romans. Every interaction he had with the Romans, he even healed some of the Roman soldiers' family. It didn't make sense to Judas, so that's a mark against Jesus. And then the other problem was, every time Jesus interacted with the religious leadership, it was a battle. See, Judas knew that if they were going to set up this coup, if they were going to overthrow the Roman Empire, they were going to need the temple on their side. They were going to need to be united. And so they pictured the Messiah as somebody who came, that the religious leaders accepted and said, "Yes, this is the Messiah," that then gave them the political, religious authority to start this process of overthrowing the Romans. But every time Jesus interacted with the temple, it was explosive. Right? He even called them broods of vipers at one point, not exactly making any friends in the temple with phrases like that. So Judas is doing all this math, and it's just not working, but he's still following it for a while. And then the other problem with Jesus was every time the treasury would grow, Jesus would empty it out. They'd feed the poor, or they'd give to charity. And so anytime they had this little war chest built up, and Judas is like, "You need money to finance a coup, and every time we get some money, you go and give it away." So he's trying to reconcile all these things, and he's managing, but then finally, something happened that was the last straw for Judas. And what's really interesting about it, and what's really telling about who Judas was, is that it was a profound act of generosity that did it. We're going to be in Matthew chapter 26, and we're going to read verses 6 through 16. It says, "Meanwhile, Jesus was in Bethany at the home of Simon, a man who had previously had leprosy. While he was eating, a woman came in with a beautiful alabaster jar of expensive perfume and poured it over his head. So they're in this little suburb of Jerusalem, Bethany. Okay, and this is about a mile and a half from the city center, which becomes important later on. So they're having dinner. They're having a really nice time. If you were at the men's advance that we did this weekend, this concept of koinonia, that's what they're having here. They're hanging out. They're having a really good time. They're connecting with each other. They're enjoying spending time with one another. There's a really great vibe in there. They're having a good dinner. It's just a really fun place to be. And this woman walks in with this jar of perfume, breaks it, and pours it all over Jesus' head. Now, this is a really strange picture to us, because this is not something that we do culturally. And I, for one, am thankful for that. So I feel like that would be weird if you're at a dinner party and somebody breaks, you know, something over your head. Generally, we would call that a bar fight, not a pleasant evening somewhere. But this perfume, the smell is filling the room. Yeah, I like to imagine it smelled like essential oils. And you know your friends with, you all have friends with essential oils. You can smell them coming. I don't mean that in a bad way. I love it. It's pleasant. But if all of a sudden you're in a room and it smells like you're standing in a field of peppermint, somebody who does essential oils has a headache. And you're aware of it. That's what I'm imagining is happening in this room. It says the smell filled the room. Not only did it fill the room, but it was probably pouring out into the street. So anybody who's walking by this place knows that something special is going on. It's powerful. It's a really interesting image of this smell filling the room. Verse 8 says, the disciples were indignant when they saw this. What a waste, they said. It could have been sold for a high price and the money given to the poor. Now, John tells us something interesting about this in his gospel that we don't get in Matthew. John tells us that this oil was worth a year's wages. Imagine, the median income in the United States is roughly $50,000. Imagine somebody walking in with a $50,000 bottle of something. Champagne, maybe, or wine. Walking into your house at the end of dinner and smashing it on the table. It would be weird for many reasons, but $50,000. Cut it in half. Imagine half of that, $25,000. Even $1,000. It is a crazy amount of money that is being used in this one instance. And the thing about these jars, there's no resealing them. The alabaster jars were sealed. They were airtight to preserve the perfume. So once you break it, you have two options. You use it all, or you put it in other bottles. Anything that's left is going to spoil. And so the disciples are thinking, man, we can make a killing with this. We could raise all of this money, we could put it in little bottles, sell it at a markup. We could feed the poor indefinitely on this year's worth of wages. And so it's understandable that this group of guys who are solely consumed with doing good things for people and have very little finances to do it would bristle a little bit at something so expensive being used in such a lavish situation. Verse 10 says, but Jesus, aware of this, replied, why criticize this woman for doing such a good thing to me? You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me. She's poured this perfume out to prepare my body for burial. I tell you the truth, wherever the good news is preached throughout the world, this woman's deed will be remembered and discussed. What strikes me here is that Matthew says Jesus was aware of this. To me, that means that the disciples are gathered at one end of the room, kind of whispering about this, going, can you believe what just happened? Can you believe she did that? You know how much we could have spent? How much we could have used? We could have used that money. My students sometimes do this. They'll get on one of the couches in the youth room, and they'll start whispering to each other. I like to sneak up behind them and go, secrets don't make friends. They're not a fan, but I think it's pretty funny. But see, Jesus didn't have to do that. He was aware of it. He's so in tune with his people, with his tribe, that it says he is aware of what they're saying. And see, he rebukes them. He challenges their thinking. He says, you'll always have the poor, but you won't always have me. And they're kind of like, I'm sure in their heads just for a second, wait, what? What do you mean we won't always have you? You're the Messiah. You're about to overthrow the Roman Empire and be our king. What do you mean we won't always have you? Right? And so they're stuck on that. And then he says, she did it to prepare me for burial. And they're like, I'm sorry. Can we back this up a little bit? I have no idea what you're talking about, right? But it doesn't even stop there. Like, the disciples don't stop to discuss that. Because if they stopped every time Jesus said something confusing to them, the New Testament would be like 100 times longer, right? They're confused. And then Jesus says something really interesting. He says, wherever the good news is preached, this story will be discussed and remembered. You know what Jesus did there? He included us in this story. Because we are here talking about it, talking about the good news, and remembering and discussing the story, which is just so cool of Jesus. that he's not only thinking about the people in the room, he's not only thinking about what's about to happen to him, but he's thinking about us 2,000 years later who are going to be involved in this story. The disciples don't get either of these things. And John actually says that the frustration didn't come from all of the disciples, but just one. Can you guess which one? Judas. That's right. Now, John says it might make sense because Judas was the treasurer. We find that out. And so Judas was responsible for the money. So it kind of makes sense that he would be a little concerned about this. They used that money to travel and to go and feed the poor and do whatever they needed to do. So on the surface, it would make sense that Judas was upset, but John also knew that Judas was scraping money off the top. And so whenever he needed a new pair of sandals or something, he'd just take it out of the treasury. And he was the treasurer, so nobody else knew the numbers. And he just did that. And John knew that. John knew that was going on. So Judas is watching $50,000 being taken right out of his pocket. And he has had enough. That is one step too far. For Jesus to defend this woman, this stupid woman, who has no idea what she's doing, how much she's wasting, he has no patience for it. So he excuses himself. Remember, they're in Bethany, which isn't far from the city center. He could easily find someone in charge at the temple. Verse 14. It says, then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12 disciples, went to the leading priests and asked, how much will you pay me to betray Jesus to you? And they gave him 30 pieces of silver. From that time on, Judas began looking for an opportunity to betray Jesus. See, the problem with Jesus was that everywhere he went, crowds gathered, right? Because he was healing people, and he was teaching things that they'd never heard before. And so everywhere he went, no matter where they went, everybody showed up. They came out of the woodwork. So the leading priests couldn't come in and arrest him then because they'd have a riot on their hands. You start a riot, the Romans get involved, the Romans kill a bunch of Jews. It's just chaos. They can't afford that. So they can't arrest Jesus without some help from the inside. Judas knows their movements. Judas knows where they're going to be because he's in the inner circle. He knows where they're going to go so he can help find a time when they're going to be by themselves and they can come in and arrest him. So Judas agrees to betray Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. That's it. But remember, in Judas's mind, he has nothing left to gain from following Jesus. The equation has become so unbalanced that 30 pieces of silver bring it back into alignment. And I could try and find some cultural modern day equivalent to 30 pieces of silver, but honestly, nothing is going to be worth a human life, let alone the life of Jesus. And Judas agrees to betray him for 30 pieces of silver. See, from Judas's perspective, this is a win-win. Because one of two things is going to happen. Either Jesus is not going to allow himself to be arrested. There's no way he's going to let this go down this way. So he'll finally throw off this coat of, you know, quiet little teacher and become super Jesus and start, you know, slapping the Romans around, which is a win for Judas because that's what he's wanted all along. Or he gets arrested, he gets a slap on the wrist, he gets whipped a couple times, and then he gets out and nobody believes him anymore and Judas can go on to the next thing quietly. Those are the two possibilities that Judas sees in his mind. Either way, he's 30 pieces of silver richer, right? So he's not going to give the money back. So this is a win-win for him. And then the drama really starts to unfold. They gather for Passover. And Jesus comes into the room and it says he takes off his rabbinical robe. Which is really, really important. It's symbolic of Jesus hanging up his authority for the moment. He ties a towel around his waist and washes the disciples' feet. Now, I'm sure you've heard about the whole foot washing thing before. But it was a gross job. Because they wore sandals and there was dust everywhere. So when you came into somebody's house, there was a servant that washed your feet so you weren't tracking dust everywhere all over the house. So that there was some semblance of cleanliness. Right? And it was usually the lowliest house servant that did this. So Jesus, of all people, Jesus Christ, the leader of these disciples, takes off his authority, hangs it up, ties a towel around his waist and starts washing their feet. And Peter's like, you are not going to wash my feet. And Jesus goes, sit down. Yes, I am. He washes their feet and he says, what I'm doing is setting the example for you. What I'm doing for you now is what you will do for people for generations to come. It is a powerful moment. And all the while, Judas is sitting there knowing what he has already done and what he is about to do. See, they had discussed after this, they're going to go into the garden to pray. So Judas knows that this is his time. But now he's got to figure out how to get out of here to go tell the priest where to meet them. So he's sitting there with a smile on his face, while Jesus is washing his feet, knowing he's about to betray him completely. And so it's this really nice mood for all the rest of the disciples. And then Jesus kills the mood in John 13:21. Now Jesus was deeply troubled and he exclaimed, "I tell you the truth, one of you will betray me." Everybody starts looking around the room, chattering, trying to figure out who it could be. "Well, it's not me. There's no way. What is he talking about?" Meanwhile, Judas is going, "How stupid have I been? I watched Jesus raise somebody from the dead, and I thought I was going to be able to pull one over on him. I thought I was going to be able to fool him. I thought he was going to have no idea that I had set this whole thing up." And now he's starting to go down some bad roads. Judas is going, "This is it for me. That stupid sword that Peter always carries around, he's going to pull it out and he's going to put it right through me because Jesus is going to tell them what I've done." This whole time, Judas has been trying to calculate this and figure out how to get out, and he's so close. And then Jesus blows the whole thing open. All of this is happening in Judas's head. The disciples are still scrambling, trying to figure out what's going on. And Jesus leans over and says this to Judas. Then Jesus told him, "Hurry and do what you're going to do." None of the others at the table knew what Jesus meant. The disciples are totally lost, thinking that Jesus has sent him to go pay for the meal or to go give money to the poor or something like that. But Judas knows what's happening. Jesus isn't just saying he knows what's going to happen. He's saying, "I know what you're about to do, and I'm not going to stop you." And even more than that, he's saying, "I know what you're about to do, and I'm not going to stop you, and I've got your back because I'm not going to let any of them stop you." And I'd imagine that that threw Judas for a loop, and he didn't know what else to do, so he goes, he leaves. Judas leaves, and Judas furthers the confusion, saying this, "As soon as Judas left the room," Jesus said, "the time has come for the Son of Man to enter into his glory, and God will be glorified because of him." See, because Jesus knows this is all going according to plan. Everything is happening exactly the way it's supposed to do. Because God's plan cannot be thwarted, overthrown, or manipulated. God's hand cannot be forced. Judas hasn't subverted anything. And his bargain did not work out the way that he thought it would. And see, it gets back to Judas that Jesus was handed over to Pilate. And Judas starts to panic. Because he knows that the Jewish authority has no law to put a man to death. So if they want to kill him, they have to appeal to the Romans. So when he hears that he's been sent to Pilate for judgment, Judas knows that they are going to kill Jesus. Remember, that was not either of the possibilities that he pictured. He thought for sure he wouldn't allow himself to get arrested, or he thought he would get arrested and it would all blow over. Now Jesus is about to get killed, and he is fraught with remorse. Matthew 27:3-5 said this, "When Judas, who had betrayed him, realized that Jesus had been condemned to die, he was filled with remorse. So he took the 30 pieces of silver back to the leading priests and the elders. 'I have sinned,' he declared, 'for I have betrayed an innocent man.' 'What do we care?' they retorted. 'That's your problem.' Then Judas threw the silver coins down in the temple and went out and hanged himself." The key here is that what was once worth Jesus' life to Judas is now worthless. It has no value whatsoever. He tosses the coins back to them because they're worthless. Just like the things that we try to trade Jesus for. We've all done it to some extent. We hold out on Jesus and try to keep something that we know we're going to lose anyway. That relationship, that job, that addiction. "You can have most of me, but you can't have that. And maybe if you do this, then I'll give you that." It's all going to go away in the end anyway. But in the moment, it's not worth trading Jesus for. See, when we barter with God, we become responsible for the outcome. When we barter with God, we become responsible for the outcome of the journey. That's the priest saying, "Hey, that's not our problem. It's your problem that you're filled with remorse. It's not our problem that you're guilty. You chose this. Now you get to live with that." I look back on some of the things that I've held on to. And in the moment, I felt so justified. "You don't understand, God. I deserve this. This is not right. This should not be happening to me. So I'm going to be angry. And I'm going to be disrespectful. And I'm not going to give in to what you want me to do because this is not right." And God says, "Okay, buddy. that's what you want to do. But I'm responsible for the outcome. And I look back at those things, and they're worthless. They're useless. They have no value. And yet I am so tempted to trade those things for relationship with Jesus. And that is exactly what Judas did. He traded his relationship with Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. When I think about this concept that I become responsible for the outcome, I think two things. I feel two things. I feel fear, first of all, because I make dumb decisions. I do stupid things. I don't want to be responsible for the outcome. I feel fear, and then I am overwhelmed by the love of God, that he would allow us to make our own decisions to our own ruin, to not impede on our free will. What kind of love is that? It's way easier to bargain with God. It's way easier to say, sure, I'll give that up, but you got to do this first. Or sure, I'll increase this, but you got to do that first. Because surrender is scary. And surrender is hard, and surrender is painful, and surrender reaches into the bottom, dark corners of our hearts and requires us to pull that thing out and hand it over to God, messy and ugly and torn from our flesh. It is so much easier to barter. But I will tell you that I would rather endure that pain than be responsible for the outcome. I would rather allow God all of me, every part of me, every day, than have to be responsible for the outcome. That's the safest, most secure place we can be, dead center in the will of God. And so my question for you this morning is, are you surrendered? What are you holding on to? What are you still trying to use as leverage with God? What parts of your heart have you not given over yet? What have you decided has value, but before long you're going to realize is worthless? I'm going to invite the worship team back up. And I just want to invite the Holy Spirit to move on our hearts. This was convicting to me. This was a challenge for me. And as I took inventory, I realized there were things that I had not completely given over to God. And I saw that I was going to be responsible for the outcome of those things. And it scared me. And that is not where I want to be. So Holy Spirit, we invite you to move right now. Would you convict our hearts? Would you shine light on those dark corners? And would you speak to us what we're still holding on to, what we are trading relationship with Jesus for in those areas? And Holy Spirit, I pray that you would give us the strength to reach in, rip those things out, and leave them for Jesus to take. Lord, I pray that you'd give us courage. I pray that you'd give us humility. I pray that we would surrender our rights, we would surrender our pride, that we would surrender our fear, and that we would allow you to completely move on our hearts. And Lord, just as you came into the city on Palm Sunday on a donkey with palm branches on the ground, would you come into our hearts in the same way? We have prepared a space for you, and we are ready to be in relationship with you. Thank you for your faithfulness to us. We love you this morning in Jesus' name.
This has been a podcast from Streams Church in the West Valley of Phoenix, Arizona. For more information, visit streamschurch.org.